lot of designs I've looked at would radiate parallel to the window, which is going to do a lot of good. I know I think a folded dipole would do it, but I don't know if I have enough space in a small window like the size of a on a computer train to fit a folded dipole into that sort of space. I have been reading about fractal antennas, and it seems to be a very heated and controversial subject. I'm not sure if you deal with those or not. So let me throw that back at you and see what you would recommend for a flat antenna that would radiate straight out from a window.
You're on the right track. All of a sudden, I've forgotten the astronaut's name. The astronaut who first did transmissions from the International Space Station.
Garriott, that could be copy.
Well, what was his name again? Oh, Owen Garriott? Yes, that's it. What was it called? It is a W5LFL, was that it?
I'm terrible at remembering the call letters. I know it was a 5. Everybody's from Texas.
Okay. Personally, so-called, talked to Owen Garriott on Space Shuttle, I think it was number 5, but I'm not sure of the exact number, 1985, while he was flying from Texas toward New York, was the path he was taking on that particular orbit, and what he had done is to make this tape dipole-like structure out of, let's call it copper foil, with a peel-off tape on one side. He peeled off the tape, pasted it against the window of the space shuttle, the upper window. The shuttle was flying upside down, so the so-called upper window is aimed toward the Earth. He connected it to his Motorola handy talkie and started talking. And by way of the certificate I got from him, I'm in theory one of the people who he talked to. Well, he didn't really talk to me. He heard my call letters in that rabble of everybody else calling him when he played back the tape recording, or when his assistant played back the tape recording. The only person he really talked to was King Hussein when he was flying over the Middle East. There was just 2 guys on 2 meters at that time. One of them was in the space shuttle, Owen Garriott, and the other one's on the ground. In the case of the space shuttle flying over the center of the United States, where he's looking at a 2,500-mile diameter of humanity all at once, let me drop. And all of those guys are calling his call letters at the same time on a 2-meter frequency. It was just wall-to-wall intermod. And so the guys who were really putting out a potent signal, the moon-bounce-capable guys, are the ones that climbed above the noise. And so the first few times that I tried talking to him, I'm pretty sure I didn't get through. Eventually, I used 4 Yagis in the top of the tower, aimed at him, carefully aimed at him, with probably I was putting 300 watts of power into it in order to get to him on 2 meters. Simplex, no repeaters involved. So, when it comes to making a tape dipole, tape hole, tape antenna that you tape against a window, nowhere near as difficult as you think. Any kind of horizontally or vertically polarized dipole-like antenna, whether it be folded dipole or non-folded dipole, is your choice. Your only requirement is that it must resonate. So if you don't have enough window space, I mean, in theory, a dipole pasted against a window is in the vicinity of 38 inches tip to tip to be a half wavelength on 2 meters. Let me drop. But the 38 inches does not have to be all out straight. You can zigzag it in all kinds of ways. You can curve it into an inverted V, or a V, or a U, or an inverted U. You can put top hat loading capacitors. You can put loading coils on it. There's all kinds of ways you can squeeze a dipole on 2 meters into the space of your window. If your window is anything more than about 19 inches wide, it's going to fly. It only has to resonate in order for it to radiate. And the exact shape, as long as the main high current portion in the center is horizontal, then you are, by definition, horizontally polarized, even though the tips are bent down into an inverted U, or into a bent it up to a U. You still are primarily horizontally polarized. And as long as it radiates, and as long as you've done a good job of impedance matching it to your transmitter, then 98% of the power coming out of your transmitter will be radiated by that dipole into space. A slight thing to worry about a little bit is that of all the power that's radiated, half of it is out of the window into free space, other half of it is in from the window toward your house. And until you are able to place another element, like a reflector or director, at the same altitude as that antenna, held at a place closer inside your house. You could build a reflector, a half-wave dipole, a little bit longer than resonant, make it roughly a quarter wavelength away, and hold that on a wooden stick of some kind in front of the window, inside of the house, so to speak, and now you could make it, let me drop. Now you could make it so that 90% of the power is radiated out and only 10% of the power is radiated in. So your highest requirement is resonance. Your second highest requirement is if you arrange it so you want horizontal or vertical polarization. That's the way you orient things. And the fact that you're 3 dB down because half the power is in the house and half the power is out of the house, that's like any dipole. If you put a dipole on 2 meters on the top of your tower, and the dipole is east-west, half your power would go to the north and half your power would go to the south. So it's no different, if you know what I mean. But if you're willing to put a reflector behind that dipole and or some directors in front, you can now favor north over all other directions if you want to. So in three-dimensional space, you could build a Yagi-like structure in your window. The materials required to do it could be the portion that's against the window could be aluminum foil or copper foil held there with scotch tape or by copper tape. So how you hold it there is a minor detail, and how you suspend the reflector if you want to build it is a minor detail, and there's a strong need for that antenna that you and I are mentally describing right now, Neil. Once you solve that problem, you're sitting on an extremely good article, and people will build a path to your door to get more information about it. It's about time we do this. Why have you waited this long, Neil? I'm having some fun with you. W2NDG, and NDG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
My vision of this is creating with some copper foil tape that I found the source for, which looks pretty good. I've got a couple other antennas I think I may make out of that here. In the new shack. So my vision is to use the copper tape on probably like a pliable, clear vinyl material, almost like I know they sell it as table and furniture protectors. I can cut that to size and then to be able to attach it to the window just with some suction cups. I'm only planning on using it with an HT for now. Obviously, if it works, then I can work on something else. I have another project which would be very similar to it, which would actually, where the antenna would be inside of the fabric, something else that I'm working on. So, I don't know. If I get this together and I can test it and it works well, I'll come back and report my findings. Thanks for answering the question. W2NDD, back to that.
Neil, you got to think a little bit more positive. You said, if you can get this working. It's not if, it's when. It's when you get this thing working. All good ideas do not work at first. But once you iron out the bugs and get this working, it's going to work like a charm. One of your first questions is, how do I get an impedance match to this folded dipole that's made out of copper tape that's pasted against some vellum-like material? And by the way, I've spent the last 8 years of my life, 9 years of my life, building a whole bunch of 900 megacycle dipole and Yagi-like antennas by taking copper tape and putting it on top of a clear plastic-like material, and then connecting coax cables to them and connecting them to a vector network analyzer. And with the vector network analyzer, I could measure the gain and the standing wave ratio. And I was displaying that in real time and then holding my tuning tools near it to find out how to make it work better while watching that display. And I display the gain as a blue curve, sweeping from 902 to 928 megs. The blue curve was the gain. A yellow curve was the VISWA. I made the blue curve go up and the yellow curve to go down. And I did that simultaneously, displaying both at the same time, superimposed on the same graph, while holding these tuning tools near the individual elements to find out, do they want to be longer or shorter? Do they want to be closer or further away? And does the impedance match want to be different? when it comes to how do you feed that driven element, let me drop. If you simply look at the WA5EJB website, go to Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. That's Kent Burton, WA5EJB from near Dallas, Texas. I can't think of the name of the town he's in right now. You go to his website. He's got a whole bunch of these green printed circuit Yagi-like antennas that he sells. Look at the 900 megacycle antenna. It's a three-element Yagi that he sells for a couple of dollars. But look at the driven element. The driven element is a dipole. Very simple feeding procedure. He's also got a series of articles in there on his second page on how to make Yagis and dipoles out of coat hanger wire. So with a very simple procedure, with a quasi-folded, half-folded dipole-like thing, that's one of his patents on a very simple feeding procedure for a dipole-like structure. You're going to be building that out of coat hanger wire or copper tape and taping it to some kind of vellum and then holding that with scotch tape up against your window and eventually going to be adding a reflector or a director to it. You might, on the other side of the window, build a director. On the input side of the window, build a reflector and hold them spaced away from the window when you want further gain out of this thing. There's a definite need for that antenna, Neil. You're on something real good here. Let me drop it. Somebody just asked a question. What was that?
Give me that name again, sorry.
Yeah, the website is Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, .com. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, .com. That's Kent Electronics of Mr. Kent, all of a sudden I can't think of his last name, Kent Britton. Same as the country. And he also has a British license, by the way. He has a lot of fun with that one. Kent Britton, with his British license and American license, he's got this website where for the last 8 or so years he's been selling these printed circuit antennas. And when you look at that procedure as to how he feeds coat hanger wire for some of those antennas, but he tells you how to home brew them, or you look at what he did on his 900 megacycle three-element Yagi, how he feeds that driven element, and the patent that I've got on a Yagi is where I took that design and I made the elements extremely fat out of copper tape in order to get more bandwidth at 900 megs. I made a three-element Yagi very fat. And if I do a little bit of research, I'll be able to tell you the patent number by which you can look at the photograph, so to speak. You look at the diagram of the three-element Yagi made out of copper tape that I built. In fact, once you know that my last name has certain patents associated with it, and you go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark, USPTO, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office of the United States Government, and you look at my name, you'll see that patent, and this is where the patent you are curious about most is the three-element Yagi made out of copper tape, which was filed somewhere around 2004, 2005. It's called a high directivity or low reflectivity antenna, as I think of the name of the patent. This is the name you don't have to care about. You just search my name, and of those 32 patent applications, and by the way, you've got to use my name corresponding with an address of Huntington or Dix Hills, because there is a relative of mine with the exact same last name who has also filed a whole lot of patents on printed circuit boards. So in order to limit the list, you have to do an OR search where you OR my last name with my town as the inventor. And so you'll find that patent. You'll see an extremely broadband printed circuit, a broadband version made out of copper tape of that Yagi that you'll see at the WA5EJB site. So I wonder if you need a fill on that, Neil. W2NDG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
For all the info, I've been poking at a couple of the websites here while I'm talking to you. So I'm familiar with searching for patents. Out of curiosity, last year I was digging for patents that my uncle, my late uncle, Erwin Brunthill, had placed some radio-related patents. He's rotator for it out of the stepper motor. So we'll see how that works too. W2NDG, back to you.
Yeah, those sound like very fun projects, Neil. And there's a definite need for those. A box on that can be mounted in an attic that can be rotatable, there's a need for that. A window antenna, indoor antennas. When you look at Ken Britton's website, WFIVJB.com, on his second or third page, you'll see these coat hanger wire Yagi antennas. We take a simple stick of wood acting as the boom and hang these coat hanger wires on it as directors and reflectors and the driven element, and you can get an awful lot of high performance out of a dollar's worth of materials, if you know what I mean. And to put that on a broomstick handle with some kind of a rotator and mount that either outside your house or in your attic, it'll get a little more performance outside the house, but that'll definitely work. Lots and lots of people think that the various antennas of a dipole-like nature, that one's going to have more gain than the other. Absolutely not. Once you have a single resonant element that's a little bit like a dipole, bend it up, zigzag it, put top hat capacitors, put loading coils, do whatever you want. It's a dipole-like structure. They all have, within a couple of tenths of a dB, exactly 2.14 dB of gain over isotropic. The fact that it is a half wavelength, approximately long electronically, and the fact that it's resonant means that it will radiate all the power you put into it once you give a good impedance match. It has an extremely predictable dipole-like pattern, and the gain will be 2 and a fraction dB over isotropic. It will be 0 dB of gain over dipole. It is a dipole. Your highest priority is to make it resonate. Your second highest priority is to give it a good impedance match. Your third highest priority is to make it out of materials that don't have a whole lot of resistance. You ain't going to get any lower resistance than you can get out of copper tape, because you can make that copper tape, various portions of it, as wide as you like.
Repeater, time out.
And when you make the copper tape wide enough, the current density on it, on the resonating portions of it, is so low that you could literally make the antenna, if you make it wide enough, you could make it out of carbon granules, and you would still get 95% efficiency, if you know what I mean. So the resistivity or the conductivity of the copper tape almost doesn't matter when you make it wide enough. As such, you could use aluminum foil with one exception. Soldering to aluminum foil is a dog. But if you're really smart, you don't have to solder to it. You can make two pieces of aluminum foil, one piece of aluminum foil separated by some scotch tape into a piece of copper foil, and the copper foil is what you solder to the shield and to the semiconductor of the coax cable. There's nothing stopping you from capacitively coupling into an antenna. Doesn't have to be a direct contact. Just that with the capacitive coupling, it's got to give you resonance and a good impedance match. And by putting a sheet of copper with a layer of scotch tape in between as the dielectric, and by the way, scotch tape, I have often made capacitors out of layers of copper tape and scotch tape. Makes a beautiful high Q capacitor. The plastic that's inside of scotch tape at 900 megacycles is an extremely good dielectric material. And then as you slowly peel the copper tape that's sitting on top of the scotch tape away from the other layer of copper tape, you're changing the capacitance value. It's a tunable capacitor. You grab it with wooden tweezers and start peeling it back. You watch the capacitance go up and down, depending on whether you're pushing it down or peeling it back. And you watch the display on the spectrum on the network analyzer, and you know where the right amount of capacitance is. You'd be amazed how much, how many interesting...
Repeater, time out.
I was starting to say, you'd be amazed how many interesting components you can make out of copper tape and scotch tape. I'll admit that building an inductor is a little bit more difficult. And maybe there you want to buy a lumped component inductor if you really need one. So inductors are not so easy to build. But capacitors and antennas and resonators, very easy to build. The materials are inexpensive. The amount of experimenting you can do with scissors and an X-Acto knife, you're going to have a grand old time. So, keep us informed on that project, Neil. You've got a good one. There is a definite demand for the product that you're about to develop. very similar to what happened to me. I wanted a high-power, easily reproduced transmitter on 432 back in 1970, and I built something called the Stripline Parallel Kilowatt Amplifier to solve my needs. And once I got on the air and started describing it to people, they said, gee, mail me a schematic. I want to build one of those. Let me drop. And pretty soon there were 30 guys out there on 432 building this thing that I had built to solve my problem. And obviously it was time to write the article and get it published. And that was in April and May, QST 1972, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's 1972, April and May, QST. Sometimes I get the years wrong. So I didn't build that to make it a popular article. I built it to solve my particular problem. That's where you are, Neil. And if you have that need, there's a zillion other hams out there. Of those 713,000 hams in the United States right now, a certain percentage of them need the thing that you're about to build. W2MDG for any other comments. KGRLAW in the tech net.
I think that covers it. I've got a good test bed here, I have to tell you. The antenna you're hearing me from tonight is a Slim Jim ladder line J-pole that is thumbtacked to the wall behind my desk here. Facing south. So, this should be a good place to test all these things out.
Yeah, the J-pole you're using now, Neil, is working. Your signal to this repeater is a little bit noisy. So, you would like an antenna of a little bit more altitude or a little bit more clearance and facing to the south. This repeater is almost west-southwest of you. So, a little more altitude will work. In the case of VHF antennas, there are three things that make them work well. You've heard me say that so often. Altitude, altitude, and altitude. The three things that make a VHF antenna on 2-meter FM work well. A ratty old coat hanger, ugly-looking, rusty antenna mounted on the top of your chimney or on the top of your tower will work like gangbusters. A $500 dual-band 2-meter 440 antenna mounted in your basement, nobody will hear you. So the altitude of the antenna counts a lot more than the individual performance and efficiency of the particular antenna. So, as I said, good luck with those, and please come back and tell us how that progress goes. Okay, now, Wes, you were asking about the magnetic field of the left-hand side of my director, of my Yagi. Let me drop. DPZ, so to speak. Who was that? Go ahead.
This is DPZ, Dick. I had a bill out in my back. I didn't hear any comments about the method of making DB measurements.
Yeah, there were no further measurements, further comments on that, Hal. He was doing relative measurements on the exact same instrument used minutes apart between antenna A and antenna B. So the exact calibration didn't matter. The fact that X number of dB, like 5 or 6 dB of difference on the dial was required to get the same signal strength into the remote antenna when he was using locally antenna A versus antenna B, that was the measurement. And so how much of it was due to multipath effects? Hopefully the two antennas were mounted at the exact same altitude, pointed in the exact same direction, but still there was significant evidence that one of his antennas was quite a number of decibels better in performance in that environment than the other antenna. That's the main thing that he was measuring. And whether or not the absolute power out of his signal generator was traceable to the bureau, to the nearest couple of tenths of a dB, in that environment, I don't think it mattered. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Now, the whole point was, when you went to the top end of that generator, the 1500, the scale is not really that accurate. And that's why if you're at the receiver end and you use a substitution method, you could then very accurately see the amount of difference in dB from one antenna to the other. That was my point of contention I was trying to put out, but I don't think you really on the same wavelength as I was trying to explain.
Yeah, and I think I see what you're saying. He did by his relativistic measured 5 dB of difference. If the real difference was 3.9 or 4.2 dB, set of five almost doesn't matter. He knew that he was getting a lot more performance out of one antenna than the other, and that's going to cause him to do further research as to what's going on with the antennas. And where he's got aluminum elements going through a boom, that is something to worry a little bit about. Dr. Henry Jasek fell into that trap. By way of elements going through the boom and his careful tuning procedure, inside of an anechoic chamber, that's part of the problem, inside of an anechoic chamber at a VHF frequency, and very few chambers have got high performance at VHF, he was trying to get maximum gain out of a Yagi. And along came a guy called KQRIW working for the same company with him, and I was claiming more gain than he thought was possible. And I was having that gain measured on a very good reflective ground plane antenna range being run by Dr. Dick Turin of Bell Laboratories. So I had reason to believe by the substitution method that I was getting something close to the gain that I was claiming, which was a couple of dB above, he thought, the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi. And this was way back in 1978. Let me drop. And in 1978, people thought that if you went beyond 18 elements of a Yagi, it was a law of diminishing return and nothing good happened. Well, by better construction techniques and good modeling techniques, nowadays you can buy high-performance Yagis with 102 elements on one single boom of a Yagi at 3 gigs, and it does give you predicted performance. So does the Yagi procedure run out of gain at 18 elements, like people used to believe? The answer is no. With good construction techniques, the answer is no. Any further comments on that one, Hal? K6DPZ, K2LIW.
Okay, K2LIW, K6DPZ, I agree with you. So, when you space the elements properly and everything, you can get a lot more gain, even more than 18 elements. Can I get a point where you dimension capacity and repeating? I wrote one of the patents stick on capacity feeding J poles. I'm sure you saw my patents on Google Patents.
Yeah, a lot of people think that capacitive loading, capacitive grounding, capacitive feeding is going to give you loss. Lots and lots of guys are absolutely positive that a mag mount antenna on the roof of a metal roof of a car doesn't give you the same performance as a Motorola hard mounted antenna with a hole through the roof. Absolutely no difference. The fact that there's a capacitor between the bottom of that magnet on a mag mount and the rest of the roof of the car, if the antenna is properly tuned and properly impedance matched with that capacitor, you'll get full performance. Now, what Wes is asking is that when I'm doing the tuning of a Yagi and I'm holding a tuning tool, which consists of a long, thin piece of wood with a piece of copper tape on the end of it. Let me drop.
Question before you go to that subject, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, I wonder if Joe tried on receive and checked the reciprocity. I wonder if he would tune into a weak beacon if he found the same loss. Just wanted to run that by you.
Yeah, if he was sending a signal, he was transmitting a signal and breaking squelch on a repeater probably of his that he owned, that was, let me pick a number, 5 or 9 miles away. So he's turning up the signal generator, his IFR 1500, until he broke squelch with the right PL tone installed. Now if he had by some means made the repeater transmit, and he measures receiver signal strength with a calibrated receiver, there's probably ways he can use his IFR to do that. Yes, in theory, he should get the exact same gain difference from the exact same transmitter that he was receiving with. If it's a real single-site repeater, he should get the same response in the other direction. And by the law of reciprocity, by receiving it versus transmitting, maybe by transmitting he saw 5 dB of difference, and receiving he may have seen 4.7 dB of difference, and therefore the real answer is maybe 4.85, so to speak. He can average the two results. But yes, it would be a secondary way of making it, and it would be a way of giving confirmation, and you got a good idea there, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, as I hear your words echoing in my empty brain, you know, about reciprocity, I thought if he tuned in on a beacon, maybe he'd hear it on one and not on another. Or like you said, key the
transmitter that he was trying to key up and see if it was... All right. You can go on to Wesley's question. Thank you. KC2WGB.
Yeah, by definition, if he now went to a beacon that's on a different antenna, on a slightly different location, in the real world, he's going to get a different result. Because whenever you're in the real world, that signal coming out of your transmitting antenna is bouncing off 1 million objects at least in that environment before the composite of all that signal gets to the other antenna that you want to receive your signal. Multipath is always there. Multipath is always zillions of times more prevalent than you know about. So if he goes to that beacon antenna on a slightly different location, maybe a slightly different frequency, all of those millions of bounces in his environment over that 9 mile range are going to add up in a different way. He's going to get a slightly different result. And because the two antennas do have a different gain, they therefore have a different beam width and a different side lobe level. Therefore, each antenna is lighting up that environment of all that multipath in a slightly different way. And so, when he listens to the beacon, maybe he's going to see 3.9 dB of difference instead of 5 dB of difference because of the way things add up. And in order to get around that problem, when I was trying to measure the exact pattern out of an RIW-19 Yagi, let me drop. This was 1978, and I wanted to measure the exact pattern as accurately as I could get, and I'll tell you in a minute why I needed to do that. I mounted the 19-element Yagi on the top of my 100 feet of tower. I carefully set up the AR-22 rotator into a strip chart recorder with a calibrated signal strength, in other words, the automatic gain control system of my receiver. I had an amplifier on it that went into the vertical axis of the strip chart recorder, and I drew a bunch of horizontal lines for the calibration of 1 dB down, 3 dB down, 5 dB down, 10 dB down, and so on, 10, 20, 30, 40 dB down on the strip chart recording. Using the real receiver, using the real automatic gain control system, measuring that voltage, and even though it's a slightly nonlinear voltage, it just means that the spacing of the lines on my chart were not evenly spaced vertically, the gain lines. But that was a minor problem. So then I would rotate the antenna, let the strip chart recorder run, while somebody out in the environment transmitted a steady state signal to me on 432 megahertz, and I got a curve. Then I would choose a different ham in a different location and get a curve, and a different ham in a different location and get a curve. Even though I've got a water tower a fraction of a mile away from me that gives me a good reflection in one particular direction, each of these hams at slightly different directions means that the bounce off that water tower in some cases came into the first side lobe, sometimes it came into between the first side lobe and the second side lobe, sometimes it came into the back lobe. That particular water tower that I know was giving me grief, I could average it out by having enough guys give me a steady state signal for 60 seconds or more while I rotated this and I drew that curve. And when I laid all those curves on top of each other and I knew the directions of arrival, I could easily see, yeah, in that particular compass direction, I always get this crazy response. That ain't my antenna.
Repeater, timeout.
That water tower was north-northeast of me. So every time I looked at each one of these graphs and I looked at the absolute heading of north-northeast, I saw something funny. I saw a funny squiggle in the pattern, and I knew that wasn't my antenna. That was the water tower. But by choosing enough guys in enough directions, I was able to average that out, and therefore I was able to, every degree of azimuth sweep, I came up with a gain number of decibels of that particular 19-element Yagi antenna. Once I had all of that data in the can, I could then figure out exactly what's going to happen when I put two of those side by side, four of them side by side, four of them side by side, stacked four high. I could then mathematically combine that real antenna pattern with the interferometry pattern, the phased array pattern, so to speak, of that whole array. Because the whole array is a very complicated pattern. There's 64 side lobes in the first plus or minus 32 degrees of azimuth. 64 recognizable side lobes in three-dimensional space are in that pattern. If you've ever seen my QSL card, you've seen that pattern that I'm talking about. So that was an exact measurement of one single Yagi, step and repeated 16 times in space to make the real phased array of the 16 Yagis. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
Boy, you did your homework there, that's for sure. All right, I'll let you go on to Wesley's question. Thank you.
Yeah, what I think he's asking is that when you're tuning a Yagi by the real-world tuning technique of holding a piece of copper tape on the end of a stick near the tip of an element, and if I'm holding it near the right-hand side or the left-hand side of that director, does it matter? When the director is mounted on an insulated block, which is the way I did it, each of my directors was sitting on a plastic, sitting through a hole in a plastic block, and the plastic block was held onto the boom with a tie wrap. As such, I could very easily slide that element forward and back to find out what the gain change would be for a different position along the boom for that element. If I wanted to, I could slide the element left and right through the plastic block, but that didn't matter. But because each individual element was essentially floating in free space, and because when you're tuning a Yagi, it's very sensitive to element length. It's very sensitive to element diameter. It is almost insensitive to element position. I could take one element at a time and shift it a couple of inches forward and a couple of inches back at 432, and very little change took place. If I accumulated all of that as different spacing between the elements, yes, something starts happening. But one element at a time, I could shift it forward, shift it back, shift it left, shift it right, rotate it so it's out of plane 15 degrees to the right or 15 degrees to the left. Very little happened. So the fact that I'm holding the tuning tool near the right-hand tip of the element, because I'm a right-handed guy, and I'm standing behind the Yagi, gives me the exact same performance as if I held it near the left-hand side. So the magnetic field of the left-hand side of that dipole or the magnetic field of the right-hand side of that dipole is really the exact same magnetic field. So I don't quite understand the question. N2XJN, K2RIW. And maybe Wes got called away, and I did hear the sound of Wes's voice, but I think he was getting tired. And we may have put him to sleep with all this jazz, John. You sure you don't have one more guy who has sent you an email? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech stand.
Let me take a quick check. Hold on 1 second.
And for anybody else within the sound of our voice, our voices, who's got a question or a comment, make your call letters and name known right now. K2RIW in the tech net.
KB2A, for a question.
Okay, I heard KB2 something, and you're fading in and fading out. So you're going to have to give us those call letters a couple of times and your name a couple of times. You're right at the threshold where you're slowly moving in and out of this repeater. Maybe you're using a handy talkie, and maybe you're moving. So there are certain positions where you come through and certain positions where you don't. KB2 blank, K2LIW, go ahead.
Once again, this is KB2
I2N,
and it was Chris. I'm wondering if you spoke about the fine, about the connector, the odd bowling.
Okay, I'm listening to you on the input. You're a little bit noisy into the machine, Chris. That's my harmonic, KB2IQN. I hear him gangbusters on the input. Yeah, what Chris is relating is an interesting incident we had tonight. A buddy of ours who runs a repeater was getting, for the last year, intermittent response. When the temperature increased, the repeater started working for a while, and then it would cut out. When the temperature went down, the repeater started working for a while, it would cut out. And the owner of the repeater connected his bird wattmeter and started measuring forward and reverse power. And at one particular time, going from the transmitter through the bird wattmeter into the duplexing filter, which in turn went into the antenna, he saw 100 watts forward and 75 watts reverse. That's bad. That's a VizWatt that's huge. It's through the roof. And so step by step, he and his buddy tried finding out where it's coming from. To make a long story short, they tried moving a couple of things. They suspected a piece of cable. Then we decided to measure the piece of cable with an ohmmeter. Couldn't find anything wrong with it. There were times when the problem disappeared. There were times when the problem came back. Finally, me and Chris and others made the suggestion, let's look at things one at a time. we eventually looked at the feed-through type N bullet that went through the cabinet. You got a bunch of electronics inside the cabinet. Let me drop. And the type N bullet feeds the signal outside of the cabinet to the external antenna of this repeater. And finally, I stood on a stool and I looked down the throat of that particular bullet that went through the cabinet, through the roof of the cabinet. I said, holy blank. And let's get this thing the hell out of here. We removed that bullet. When we looked at the other side of the bullet, the exact same failure mechanism. The bullet had as its center conductor, this is a female-to-female feed-through type N bullet. The center conductor was strange in that it had not the usual four fingers on the female center conductor. It had only two fingers. One finger was almost broken away and touching the outside. And when you look at the other end of the bullet, again, it was two fingers, one of them broken away, and almost touching from center conductor to ground. And it was like a 64th of an inch away. So as temperature went up and down, that thing that was, that flake of the center conductor finger was off to one side, sometimes touching and sometimes not touching, and the remaining finger was only giving them light touching to give them feed-through power. So this was a really lousy feed-through. And so at first I said the only way you can break away a finger like that is to use a cable that has a male connector with a type N male center conductor that's much too long, which stabs the center conductor female of the adjacent bullet and damages it. Let me drop. And we carefully looked at all of the cables they've ever installed into that bullet, and they all were up to spec. None of them had a protruding center conductor male pin that was too long. And then as I studied the center conductor of the bullet a little bit longer, I said, something strange here. First of all, it only has two fingers instead of four. It must be brand X. But then as I looked at it more carefully, I realized that the hole in the center, when the two fingers are together, was too small. This was one of those very rare, long-threaded bullets that was made for 75 ohms. There is a kind of type N connector that is intended for 75-ohm service. This was one of them. The 75-ohm connector has a center conductor that's very small in diameter. The type male type the center conductor in type male also is a very small diameter thing. Therefore, its pin creates very little spreading of those fingers. You take a 50-ohm type N male connector, and you stick it into a 70-ohm, 75-ohm female type N connector. On almost every occasion, you will damage it. It's not made for that interface. So this was one of those very rare bullets that the owner of the repeater had picked it up and used it because it had a very nice barrel that was good and long and threaded throughout the whole length with no flange. So you could decide what depth you would install it onto a cabinet. You could make it stick out a whole lot longer on the outside or the inside, whichever way you like, because it was threaded along the outside of the barrel. So physically, it was a very desirable looking thing, but you got to look very carefully. Let me drop it. You got to look very carefully at that center conductor. Although it's a rare item, there are a small number of those type N male, female, double female bullet connectors out there that are made for 75-ohm service. And if you try using those, one of those in the 50-ohm world, you're going to suffer. I wonder if you guys have ever run into that one. That's a pretty rare one. KC2WGB, or anyone else who wants to talk, K2LIW listening.
KC2WGB. Dick, did it originally, the 75-ohm double female, did it originally only have two contacts on each end?
Roger, Dodger. And in order for it to have a very small diameter center conductor, appropriate for 75-ohm world, there isn't room there for making four pedals, four fingers, without the fingers being so small that they'd be very easy to break off. So I am guessing a significant number of type N 75-ohm double female bullets do only have two fingers. And, boy, that cannot tolerate the great big center conductor that's on a 50-ohm piece of cable. Over to you, John.
Very interesting. Good to know, because when you have the calibration kits for 50 and 75 ohm, you plug that into the wrong cable, even though it's an end connector. That'd be a disaster. Never knew that.
Are you saying, John, that the calibration kits that you own, and some of them are very expensive, I'm trying to name of the, remember the name of the company in California that makes cal kits for Hewlett-Packard. What's the name of the, just tell me the name of the company. Anyhow, you're telling me they don't have a great big warning telling you, make sure you never plug a 75-ohm connector into a 50-ohm piece of cable. Over to you, John.
No, and I have the original box. It was brand new. There's nothing in that box that deters you from plugging in a wrong piece of coax cable that you would think you would stick an end connector on. This is 75-ohm, and just plug it in. Boy, oh boy. And, you know, these kits are at least used. They're like $2,000.
What's the name of the California company that makes the most popular calibration kits for coaxial connectors and coaxial terminations? What's the name of that company, John?
I only know a couple of them. There's Microline, and there's another company. I don't remember, but I don't know who makes it for HP. I thought they made their own.
I used to also think they made their own. Now, there's a company in California that does a real good job, and Hewlett-Packard has given up making their own. They just buy this thing and relabel it. So they take this company, CalKit, and just buy it from the company with the Hewlett-Packard label on it. I've seen those things. I've been using these things for 10 solid years, and now all of a sudden I can't think of the name of it. Thank goodness I'm not getting over, I guess, forgetful, John. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to have to check. I'm going to open that up and take a look at it. I remember using it once, but it was being plugged into 75-ohm gear, so I never had a problem with it. But now I'm going to look and see if they're damaged. That's a possibility.
Okay, with the 3.5 minutes left, did you find another interesting email, John?
No, Dick, and I checked the chat room just to make sure, and nothing there. So that's about it for tonight.
For all the people who are listening to us, if any of them are left, who was the big winner of the Academy Awards? Anybody know?
Who were?
Who was that again?
Oh, it's Chris. I said, you were the winner. You missed the awards.
Chris says, I'm the winner because I missed the awards. It looks like people either watch the awards or they listen to the TechNet, but they don't timeshare between the two. That makes sense. Okay. I think we've gone through enough for one night, and things went a little easier than I expected. So 73, you all, you just heard TechNet number 1,496 of the series. And John and I and Hal and Paul will be back next week, if all goes well. And keep all those electrons moving. 73, you all, and be kind to each other. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, I'd like to thank everybody for participating and the people who joined the chat room. Very interesting. So, we will return next week, unless you can find out a reason why. But it's always fun. Have fun, Dick. And hello, Chris. I don't know what happened to Wes. KC2WGB will be clear.
Give me a couple of hints, John. What kind of comments did you see on the chat room tonight?
Well, including last week, there were several comments on how much they enjoy it and, you know, keep up the good work, things like that. I also get those in emails. I got two this week of just comments from people, and they're from all over, Dick. You know, just if you remember last week, we had from the state of Jalisco in Mexico. We had questions there. So we're out there, that's for sure. We're being heard.
I think you said last week we had a guy from Guadalajara, isn't that true?
Yes, Guadalajara, capital of Jalisco in Mexico.
I think you own a piece of land in that area, don't you, John?
Yes, that's why I'm so fond of Jalisco. And that was the original spot where mariachi music came from. So when you hear it, you can think of Jalisco.
Well done, John. Bye-bye for now.
great day. Have fun. KC2, WGB clear.
Just think, there's a 1 microwatt signal out there trying to time out the machine.
It's about the same IQ level. Sounds right.
N2XJN, KC2WGB. Nothing hurt, KC2WGB clear.
KC2WGB. This is N3JH.
KC2WGB, good evening, Andy.
Good evening, John. As usual, this is the time I walk in at the end of the net. But I was going to ask you, did you go to the airfare today?
No, I was about to go, but I was worried with the weather. Well, the weather was supposed to be so inclement, I was worried about not making it back. They were talking about some heavy rain with ice before the snowstorm, but it seemed like nothing happened. You know, so my boo-boo.
All right. Well, I didn't go, although, I don't know, I have a funny feeling somebody tried to call me today. My phone was ringing early this morning for no reason. So, how was the net tonight?
It was very good. We had some interesting problems. Joe, RYY, he had a question on two Yagis that he was talking to Dick about, where he had a discrepancy in gain, and he was wondering why there's a difference of 6 dB. And Dick gave him some tips on what to look for. So maybe he'll come back next week with some information on that. That was the most interesting.
Well, we'll see. Well, Dan, what can I think of? Depending on the frequency, it can be a little critical, but basically you've got the spacing, the elements, which is not overly critical unless you're, 1.2 gig maybe, but even then, it's... 50 dB is quite a lot to lose. That is a tough one.
Yeah, Dick went through explaining to him about the connections and the elements on the Yagi where there may be some minor corrosion which could be giving a problem. And both of them were tested, of course, at the same exact frequency. But what he was doing is he was transmitting a test signal to Tripper Repeater, which was approximately 9 miles away. And he found that he needed an additional 6 dBs with one antenna, 6 dB more with one antenna than he did with the other. And they're both mounted in the same location and both transmitting the exact same frequency. And that's his dilemma. Be interesting what he comes up with.
Yeah, I guess the easiest thing to blame it on would be corrosion, no matter what frequency it is. Yeah, it makes sense. That's a good point. But you got to hear the whole thing, and I guess I'd have to listen to it. You know, you have to assume if you're talking about antennas to two Yagis that they're brand new, rather than two 20-year-old Yagis, that type of thing. Every bit of information is helpful.
Yeah, very true. What I questioned was, I wondered if he had tried to use them as receive and go to a beacon or go to something else that's maybe even closer by and see if he has the same attenuation on the same antenna. You know, that would be a affirmation of his problem. But, I mean, the testing he's doing sounds like a good, legitimate test. Hal had chimed in and said it may have been the generator he was transmitting with, that the output attenuator may not be calibrated exactly right, but it really doesn't matter because he had to increase it, so it should have done the same performance, should have been achieved, and it wasn't, and that's what made it interesting.
Yeah, interesting, absolutely. Never had two Yagis. Actually, when they have to assume, I'll have to assume they're exactly the same model. They were homebrew, but I never had two of the same Yagis.
These were two Yagis, I think similar age. They weren't new, and one was a slightly higher gain than the other, but that being compensated for, it still wasn't doing the right work. And Joe's pretty good at doing that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know when I was listening. I might have turned the radio on the night before, possibly, or I don't know when. I just thought that I heard that you said you were going to go, and the AFS, and, well, maybe I'll wait for the, well, that was the indoor one, but maybe I'll wait for a warmer weather one, and I'll get out there just to say hello to everybody, and of course you. I haven't gone to them. I've gone to one or two of the past 10 years.
Yeah, I've only been to about five of them, and they're very nice. But I will try to make Briarcliff. I like Briarcliff also. That's the outdoor one. And it's usually in the time when we have fairly good weather. I'll have to check the schedule, see when that's going to be. I don't want to go too far. Always enjoy putting faces to the call signs and talking to the people I know, and be fun.
Yeah. I don't know if it's ever disappointing. you have to put together a mental image picture. You I could probably pick out of a small group of people that saw your picture. I know I was able to look out west when I saw him. I saw him somewhere. Picture of something that's not even there anymore. I know I can reference him. And of course, I met him a couple of times, so I know him now. But the first time I met him, I even did that. RIW, the first time I met him, like 10 years, I believe.